Okay. Just let yourself relax. We'll just do a meditation for a little bit. Let your body relax and take some deep breaths. Just come into the room. And give your mind a chance to just simply relax and wander. And just let yourself be a friend to your mind, supportive. Interested friend. And just notice whatever your mind happens to be feeling or thinking about. And give it some space to do that. Let your mind and body completely relax. That doesn't mean stop it from thinking or feeling. It just means to allow it to relax, to do whatever it's doing in a relaxed way, where you're not clinging or trying to make anything be different. You're simply allowing it to be as it is. And let yourself just be aware of the body, seated, the position of the body, the physical sensations of the body. As the body relaxes, just notice its presence. Notice your embodiedness in the body. And be aware that this body is breathing. It's a breathing body. And be aware of whatever thoughts or feelings are passing through the mind. It's a thinking, feeling body, all of which you're aware of. How does your own presence, the one who's aware of this thinking, breathing, body, just your own presence, the one who is the conscious being, your sense of self, kind of the innermost subject, me. You don't have to not be aware of the body. You don't have to not be aware of your mind. It's just shifting the attention to acknowledging your own presence. The one who is present to all of these things that are known to me. Just letting the mind relax into that stable presence of myself. The one who's present to every thought, every feeling, every sensation, the one who's constantly there, changeless. Mind continue to relax without holding on to it in any way. Let it do whatever it may be doing. Just let yourself recognize your own presence, the one who's there present to all of the thoughts and feelings, the one who doesn't come and go. Your own presence, which is absolutely stable, changeless. The thoughts and feelings come and go. Perceptions come and go. You don't come and go. Your being is constant. The conscious being that you are. Is the stable presence. Changelessly present, no matter what the experience, no matter what the thought. whatever the thought or the perception or the feeling, whether the feeling be happy or sad. I illumine all of them. All are known to me. I illumine them. I'm not changed by them. A happy thought negates a sad thought. A sad thought negates a happy thought. But neither negate me. I'm the changeless, conscious being, present to the sad thought, present to the happy thought, changelessly present to all experiences that come and go. Om Bhadram Karne Vishrinuyama Devaha Bhadram Pashe Makshapirya Jastraha Stirai Rangai Istushtu Vagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahitam Yadayuhu Swastina Indra Vrittashtravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swasti nastarakṣo arishtanemihi, swasti no brahaspatir tathātu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We're on verse 2 of the second section or third section. Just repeat after me. Divyo Himurta Purushaha, Divyo Himurta Purushaha, Sabahya Bhyantaro Hyajaha, Sabahya Bhyantaro Hyajaha, Aprano Himanaha, Aprano Himanaha, Shubro, Shubro Hyaksharat Paratav Paraha, Shubro Hyaksharat Paratav Paraha. Okay. Remember, this section is really the beginning of the... Sunday. Okay. Divyaha hi amurtaha purushaha sa bahya abhyantaraha Vajrahi Vajaha. Apranaha Hi Amanaha Shubraha Hi Aksharat Parataha Paraha. Really, the unfoldment now of the Upanishad of the Paravidya, which really is the whole teaching methodology that's meant to make you recognize the nature of yourself. That's now beginning, the Paravidya. And remember, the beginning when they spent so much time talking about the difference between Aparavidya and Paravidya, where Aparavidya really is the whole, all of the knowledge that deals with everything that takes place within the creation, everything that takes place within avidya. So all of the Rig Veda, all of the Vedas, everything. The study of all of the Vedas, all of Dharma, Adharma, all of the different lokas, all of the knowledge that we have to gain within the creation, within duality, that's aparavidya. That even includes studying all of the Upanishads. You could read all of the Upanishads, study all of the Upanishads, memorize all of the Upanishads. But that memorization of the Upanishads or the reading of the Upanishads is not going to give you paravidya. Paravidya means that highest knowledge is the actual cognition, the recognition of what the Upanishads say, right? which takes place through really the teaching methodology, the handling of the Upanishads as a pramana, as a means of knowledge to make me see. Right? The Upanishads are meant to teach the students a guru-sisha relationship where the words are unfolded in such a way to make the student recognize what the words are pointing to. And that requires a cognition, right? A recognition. A recognition is much different than just memorizing what the Upanishads have to say. And that's just kind of book learning or theoretical learning. But if an Upanishad is actually taught, then the student is guided step by step by step to differentiate my own presence, my own being, to recognize my own being, which is here right now, and to recognize the relationship of my own presence to all of this world of experience that is also here right now. They both are here right now. I am here, and this world of experience is here. Another way of saying that, the self-evident experience of my own presence, me, I am here. And then all of the experiences that come and go are also here. All of the thoughts in my mind, all of the emotions, all of the perceptions, even the I thought, the ahankar, I am doing this, I am doing that, perceptions of the physical body, all of the sense perceptions, right? Everything that I see through a microscope or a telescope, everything I imagine, everything I feel, everything I think, these are all perceptions. They're all cognitions in a sense. They're all experiences that come and go. So there's something to note here. There are all of these experiences that come and go that are called experiences that are objectifiable. They're objectifiable experiences. And what I mean by that is all of these experiences that I call objectifiable, they are known to me. They require my presence, right? They require my attention, right? For instance, when we did the meditation, when I become aware of my physical body sitting here, I'm relaxed, I'm aware of the body sitting here, the whole posture of the body. My attention is now on this physical body. This physical body is objectified. This is an experience. There's other times when I'm talking to my friend or doing this or doing that, I'm not objectifying my body at all. Like right now, even at this moment that I'm talking about the body, you're probably not objectifying your little toe. But now that I've mentioned it, you know, now that I've mentioned it, it becomes an objectifiable experience. If I ask you to become aware of your thoughts are objectifiable also because you know what you're thinking, you know, and you know what you're feeling, and you can describe your thoughts. You can sit there and watch your thoughts, kind of like a movie. These are objectifiable experiences that come and go. So, actually, we can divide all experience into these two things. It's either myself, my own presence, the me, the conscious being that is present, right, and always present, and then there's everything else. Everything else. whether it be a thought in the mind, a mood, an emotion, a fantasy, a feeling, or a perception. And the perceptions take place through the five sense organs, including the sense of touch. That's how I'm aware of this body, right? Without the sense of touch, you wouldn't be aware of the body. So all of these are objectifiable experiences that I watch change. So there's two things now in this world of experience. There's my own presence, and then there's everything that I illumine. It's what the Upanishad needs to do is to let me recognize the difference between what is me and what is illumined, and then what is the nature of all of this stuff that is illumined? What is its nature in reference to me? What is my nature, the conscious being, right, that is present, changelessly present to all of the experience? And then what is the nature of all of this experience? Is it separate from me? What is it? Because it's here and I experience it. I'm the subject, it's the object, right? So what is the relationship between me, the subject, and this, the object? This, the object, we learn right off the bat, stands for much more than I had taken it to stand for initially. Usually, this body is the subject and everything else is the object. Just as you're walking around in the world, I'm the subject, you're the object. But as the Upanishad unfolds, what we realize is this body is also an object known through my five sense organs, so it's also part of the world. My sense organs, which are aware of the body and the world, they're also objects known by my mind. I know if I'm blind, I know if I can see well, I know if I can hear, they're also objects. Also belongs to the universe, right? They're illumined by me also. My thoughts also, all of my thoughts. I can watch my thoughts, all of my feelings. They're also known. They also belong to the world of the object. They're all objectifiable. So once I start, this is not something we usually think about. We don't usually differentiate my own presence, this presence, me. We don't usually differentiate. We usually let that just be the body, mind, sense organs conglomerate, and this body, mind, sense organs conglomerate is walking around in this world which is other than me. But when we analyze it, this body and mind and sense organs and thoughts and moods and emotions, actually they're part of the world. They're as objectifiable as the rest of the world. And the only thing that's left that's not objectifiable is me, the subject. And if I could objectify me, the subject, then I would be the subject objectifying whatever that was. Right? So that's why we say you, the conscious being that you are, is kind of the bottom line. You can't objectify yourself. You can only be yourself. That's why we say that yourself is the conscious being that you are is self-evident. And so when we sit in meditation, I want you to just kind of understand this word, self-evident, what we mean by it. When we sit in the meditation and we just relax the body and notice your body, notice your breathing, notice the thoughts in your mind, just let them relax, then notice your own presence. Right? You are there. And then if you recognize, okay, this presence that your mind then says about this awareful being that you are, oh yes, I am an awareful being. It's labeling your presence. Your presence, the awareful being that you are, is illumining this thought that says, I'm aware, yes, I'm an awareful being. Okay? Your own presence, the awareness, labels this objectified thought. But the awareness itself can't objectify itself. It can't know itself as an object. It just knows itself as the subject. There's no subject-object relationship. There's no awareness-knowing awareness. There's just the awareness which is its own experience. But you can't get behind it. You can't go any farther than that. And because you can't go any farther than awareness, you can't objectify it, you can't make yourself change. Because you can't objectify yourself to do anything about yourself. You are the bottom line. It's just your own silent, quiet presence that's indisputable. Nobody can do anything about it. Your mind can't do anything about it. That itself is a wonderful, wonderful realization that my being is present to whatever thought is there in the mind, whatever experience is there, my being is present to that. Positive or negative, whatever the experience is, it illumines it. The one who illumines it isn't changed by what it's illumining. It's like if you think of the example of the sun shining down on the clouds. It's shining down on a thunderstorm. It's illumining the thunderstorm. The thunderstorm is its own experience, right? It's a thunderstorm experience. The sun is not having the thunderstorm experience. The sun is illumining the clouds. See the difference? The sun is its own experience, illumining the clouds. When the clouds go away, the sun is now still exactly as it was before, but now just illumining the whatever the scenery is. From the standpoint of the sun, there's no differentiation or separation, no change in experience whatsoever. So when the mind realizes this in reference to myself, my mind, which enjoys my own presence, the conscious being that I am, whether that mind is happy or sad, it's illumined. The happy mind is illumined, the sad mind is illumined. That happy or sad mind is illumined. The one who illumines it is not happy or sad. The one who illumines the happy or sad mind is exactly what it is. Like the sun doesn't become anything but the sun. Awareness doesn't become anything but awareness. And the happiness and the sadness and all of the different thoughts that we have come and go, I don't. It is this self that needs to be differentiated and then needs to be recognized in reference to all of these experiences that come and go. And so here, in this chapter, it started out, he starts out the chapter giving an example in the first verse that we looked at last week. He starts out giving an example, and he starts out like this. Today, Tet Satyam, what I'm going to tell you, this is true. This is the truth. This is the nature of reality, right? Today, Tet Satyam. What he says, he says, just as in a well-lit fire, say there's a well-lit fire, how sparks are flying from the fire. Those sparks are of the same nature as the fire. There's no difference between the substance of the sparks and in the fire. All is nothing but fire alone. You happen to be seeing many, many different forms, because the sparks are of all different sizes. But in reality, there's only one thing there, and that's fire. He uses that example, and then he says, like that, from what he calls the akshara. Akshara means that which is immutable, the atma, the self, which is changeless. That change, and that, now this is the self they're talking about. The self, my own presence, which is akshara, it's immutable, it can't change at all. Like that, from this self, from Brahman, this atma, which is Brahman, which is infinite and changeless, like that, all of these jivas come. All these were all sparks. Right? All of these names and forms that we experience, all of these bhavas, bhavaha, all of these jivas, they appear to be different. This body is different. This body is different. This person is different. This person is different. This animal is different. This worm is different. This bird is different. All of these living beings, all of them seem to be separate. But in fact, just like the sparks, just as the sparks come from the fire, are sustained by the fire, and go back into the fire. Like that, all of these beings come from the Akshara, come from Brahman, are sustained by Brahman, and go back into Brahman. So this is a big statement. And it's also using what we call a drishtanta. It's using an illustration that it has to go on to explain, because there's every illustration is limited, because the sparks illustration, if you think of a fire, the fire emits sparks, and then there's a spark out here, and then there's a space, and then there's a body of fire here. So there's the spark is removed from the fire. Whereas in terms of the self, there's nothing removing. There's nothing removed from the self. So it's not like you're a separate little spark of consciousness and you're a separate little spark of consciousness and there's a big consciousness somewhere else. It's not like that. But that's taking the drishtanta too far. What it's saying is that the consciousness that each one of you enjoy, which seems to be divided by space. Right? There's a conscious being, space, here's another conscious being, space, here's another conscious being. So like that, there's all of these, the space, these are all like sparks, appear like sparks because of the upadis, because of the conditioning adjuncts, because of the space, right? Between these little pockets of consciousness. But in actuality, there's only one consciousness, which appears to be many because of these different conditioning adjuncts. So he has to go on now to make this clear. He's given one big statement, and now he has to, the Upanishad has to unfold what is meant by that. So starting out, the Upanishad wants to tell you, what do we mean by Brahman, or this conscious being? What is this conscious being that we call Brahman? First word, divyaha. The word divyaha comes from the root div, and it means luminosity. It's used for consciousness. That which is a swatmani bhavaha means that which abides in itself. That which is consciousness itself, light itself, self-evident, self-effulgent are words that we use to translate divyaha. Another word for divyaha is alaukika. Alaukika means it's that which is but which cannot be objectified as any object in the world. All of these things that we experience are laukika. Laukika means they belong to the world. They can be objectified. Anything that's laukika can be objectified. It can be seen. Myself, consciousness, I can't make it into an object. So I can never hold it out to you and say, look, you know, like I can say, look, these are glasses, right? I can I can show them to you. I can't say, look, this is consciousness, right? This is an example of consciousness. You can't do that because consciousness is alaukika. It's not something that can be objectified. The only reason the Upanishad can point out what consciousness is to you is because you are that. Right? Because you are that, the words can point to you. But otherwise, it would be impossible because consciousness is not an object. So unless it's your very being, there's no way for the Upanishad to make you understand it. Because it would be something else in some other dimension, somewhere, somehow. not even a possibility. But because you are that, that which can, even though you can't be objectified, you are that, the Upanishad can point it out to you. So it says, that which is divya, the conscious being that you are, is divyaha. And being consciousness, it is amurtaha. Amurtaha means your consciousness. And I want you to take this back to the meditation, or take this back to yourself. When we're talking about the conscious being, we aren't talking about anything other than your own presence. It's the consciousness that you are, not an experience of consciousness that you might have later. It's the experience of consciousness, the conscious me, your own most intimate self-experience. It's that consciousness that we're talking about. So now, So now, if you just think of your own presence, if we say you, the conscious being that you are, is Divyaha, what does that mean? It means you are consciousness and you can't objectify it. That your consciousness, this me, the sense of self, you can't look at it as an object. It's consciousness, it's self-evident, but it's not something that you can objectify. That's Divyaha. Now, because you can't objectify it and it's just consciousness, it's Amurtaha. It has no form. Consciousness has no form. It's not round or square or tall. It doesn't not human form. It's not the form of a thought in the mind. Because all of these things that have form are objectified. They're known, right? If the consciousness had a form, how would you know that? Right? It would have to be illumined, right? What has form has to be illumined. So consciousness can't have form. Your being, when you... And it's such a beautiful question to ask yourself when you're just sitting, just with your own self, me. Just your own, the me, right? What form are you? You can... The word, this word form, applies to the body. Well, I'm this form. You can describe your body. Or you can use the word form to describe the type of thought you're having, right? Or the type of mood. You can use form for that. Yeah? But when you think of yourself, just your being, what form is it? The word is irrelevant. Your own presence, consciousness, which is non-objectifiable, has nothing to do with form. You know. And then if you try to think, me, my own presence, am I big or I'm small? Am I yellow or red? These words are meaningless. Am I tall? Body's tall. Am I happy or sad? I can't be happy or sad because I illumine both. This is an interesting thing. Even when you think of form in terms of emotion, for instance. And I say, I use the word form even for emotion because one... Emotion will negate another, and so they have a form in the sense that when this emotion is here, that is not. So one emotion limits another. So in that way, right? But now look at I am, and I illumine and am present to happy emotions and sad emotions. That's why I can say, oh, I was happy yesterday, I'm sad today, I'm agitated, or I'm angry, or I'm upset, or all is well with me. So many things. These are all experiences I'm having in the mind. And those are descriptions of those experiences. And they negate each other. So when the happy experience is there, the sad experience isn't there. Right? And then the happy one comes, and the sad one, and the happy, then sad. And all kinds of them come. They come and go. I'm present to all of them. So what is my experience? What am I like? Can I describe myself as happy or sad? Or probably not, because happy, sad... These are all relative terms that are descriptive of experiences I have in reference to my mind in the world. So it's not really a description of me. So the Upanishads use the word for a description of my own being as ananda. That they'll use such it ananda to describe, to as words to point to what is, how to describe my own presence, this me that's right here. Well, one word they use, and all these words are pointing to the same thing. One, they say, well, okay, I am. I exist. Me, this me. I am, I exist. And I am conscious. And I'm a conscious being. And when I'm sitting silently just with myself, you can recognize what, yes, I am, I'm a conscious being. But then, what am I like? What is this conscious being like? What's the flavor of me? You know, ananda. What does ananda mean? In the world, it means bliss, but this, and bliss in the world is comes and goes. I don't come and go. So if I, they've chosen the word to describe my own self, it's ananda, meaning wholeness or fullness or limitless or that which is complete in itself. Or sometimes it's described as the beloved, you know. Right. So why would all of these words be used? Because they're just words to try to make you look at yourself and, oh, they're using the word the beloved to describe me, the sense of self. Does that word fit? Or sometimes they use the word love to describe me. Or they use the word wholeness, completeness. And when you're just kind of with yourself, you probably say, yeah, all of those words are, those words are good. Those words work. Because actually there's nothing more dear to me than my own being. There's nothing more full or whole or complete. And it is ananda, it is the most beloved, because I don't want it to go. I don't want it. If you really, say if you're really sitting with yourself, say you've done some japa, whatnot, just enough to, just to differentiate that your own presence. And then you have your mind say, well, would I like my being to be different or someone else? You can't even imagine it. You might want your thoughts to be different. Like, I wish I wasn't thinking about this all the time. You know, or I wish that my mind would just relax and be calm and nice and happy. And, you know, I wish my body would be like this or that. That's different. You want a different set of experiences, right? Because you want to change these experiences. But what about me? Do you want this me, yourself, to be different? You don't want to be somebody else. That's the ananda. That's the sat-chit ananda. So that requires, that's a tremendous relief for the mind when that has been differentiated, the fullness of your own self that is always present no matter what the mind happens to be doing. The wholeness of yourself is always there. And the mind, once it realizes that that self is non-objectifiable and is formless, means nobody can hurt it in any way at all. Nothing can be done. Then the mind feels safe because it has a home that even it can't hurt. It can't do anything to it. If the world can't do anything to it, and it, you have to wait, and it can't do anything to it either. And so it just relaxes there, right? That's that differentiation. Usually that self has not been differentiated at all. So this teaching is designed to make the student see that. So that's divyaha amurtaha. They're talking about this Brahman, that innermost self, which is the reality of this creation, actually. That is that purusha, means Brahman. That purusha is divyaha and amurtaha. What does purushaha mean? Purusha means, the first part, pur, means purna, that which is infinite, that which is absolutely full and complete. Comes from the root pr. Pr means to fill. Purna is a past passive participle. It means that which has been filled. So that which is full, right? The self can't be any more than it is. It is infinite. It's absolutely full. It's purnaha. And purusha means purishayaha. Purishayaha means that purusha is abiding in the body. Now, what is formless in consciousness can't abide in the body any more than space can abide in the pot. Right? So if I have a pot, space isn't abiding in the pot. In fact, the pot is abiding in space. I move the pot from point A to B. It's moving through space. But if you have pot ignorance, pot space ignorance, you think that the space belongs to the pot, that the space is contained in the pot. Like that, the purusha, this atma, the self that you are, this mind, if it has self-ignorance, It thinks that the self, the conscious being that you are, is contained in the pot, contained in the body, contained in the mind. And so therefore, if it takes itself to be that the self, which is changeless, is contained in the mind, or contained in the body, when the body becomes old, you know, then the self is becoming old, right? When the mind is becoming agitated, the self is then becoming agitated. But in fact, the mind is, the self is not contained in the mind, but the mind is contained in the self. In the sense that, what I mean by that, is that the mind can never get away from the self. Just like the pot can never get away from space. The pot's trying to move away from space. Yeah? Look at this illusion. The pot space thinks it's going to go for a walk. Okay? And it feels itself, right? It feels itself going for a walk because wherever it's going, the space is there, right? Isn't that true? Wherever it goes, the space is there. So it thinks now the pot space has gone for a walk. But actually, the space hasn't moved at all. The pot has moved within space. See that? The space, nothing's happened to it whatsoever. Now what if the pot drops and breaks? What's happened to the space? Has there been the slightest crinkle, you know, when that pot drops? Has anything happened? Nothing. This is our condition. The Atma, the self, the Purusha, that's abiding in the body from the standpoint of this mind and body, right? It says, you know, that myself is abiding in me. Actually, I am the constant, right? I am the constant that never changes in any way. I'm the one that illumines all of these things that are changing. All of these things that are changing come and go. I remain the same. So if I remain the same as all of them come and go, when the pot drops, what happens to me? Right? When the body drops, what happens to me? Zero. Nothing at all. I'll tell you where you have this experience so you can experience the totality of this. It's just like when you have a dream at night and you're identified with one of the characters in the dream and there's all kinds of activity going on. And it's so real, you're just totally in the dream. And the alarm goes off. Right? The dream vanishes. The dream character that you were identified vanishes. Whole universe is gone. What is the self experience? Is there a death experience? No. How much isn't there a death experience? There isn't anything. Nothing happens. That's Purusha. That's the Purusha, the one who is absolutely complete, absolutely full, who is abiding in the body from the standpoint of who? From the ignorant mind in the body, right? Because the mind is not away from the self, right? Your mind is not away from consciousness. It's not that there's consciousness over here and the mind over here, right? And where are you located? Are you located in the mind or in the self? Where's the self-experience? When I say, where are you located, that's a misnomer, okay? Let me put it this way. Are you the self or are you the mind? You're the self, right? You're the one that illumines the mind. The mind goes unchanging. So you're the self. So where's the self-experience located, in the self or in the mind? The self-experience that makes me me is the self, is the conscious me. So what gives me my experience of me? The self, right? So the mind comes and goes, which is just a thought. The dream comes and goes, which is just a thought. That comes and goes. It does not contribute one way or the other to me, to what makes me me, because I am the self, right? And so that self experience never comes and goes. Now look at it in terms of all of the different thoughts you have in your mind. You have a sad thought, an agitated thought, an unhappy thought. Those are not the, if they're negative thoughts, they're not the nicest environment. It's not that your mind enjoys those thoughts. But those thoughts do come and go, and they are experienced when they're there. But they come and go, and you remain. You were there before, during, and after. The only problem is that it's a lot easier if you have some bad thoughts and you don't have this, you're not under the delusion that you are those thoughts. If yourself is intact, if your mind recognizes itself and has differentiated itself from your being, then when these negative thoughts are taking place, they're taking place in you and you are not the negative thought. Right? So the negative thoughts have a home, which is stable and which is not negative. See what I mean? The sick, hurt, negative, angry thoughts have a home which is not negative, and they can come and go. Just like the happy thoughts, the joyous thoughts, the wonderful thoughts, the loving thoughts, they also have a home which doesn't come and go. The self doesn't come and go, whether it's ugly thoughts or beautiful thoughts. And so that gives a tremendous amount of freedom for you to give space to the whole process of your mind as it matures. And, you know, you learn how to be with your mind. You learn how to take care of your mind as you take care of an instrument. You know, or that's a kind of as an object, where you take care of your mind and raise your mind as you would a little child. A person who gains self-knowledge, the buddhi, you know, the intellect, the one who sees clearly, then knows how to be with the mind and the moods and the emotions, and learns how to bring the mind up, right? How to be with the mind. But it can do that because the self is free and it has that free home. So anyway, so here, divyaha amurtaha purushaha. Now that purushaha, it says, you know, the one who is purnaha, who is purishayaha, the one who's absolutely full but abiding in the body, that one is both inside and outside, sabahya abhyantaraha. As soon as you say that, because if you think, oh, the self, me, I'm abiding in the body, no, you're abiding inside and outside, right? Inside and outside. How? How is that? When you recognize that not only in this room, not only is everything that I see in this room right now, I'm aware of, right? I'm aware of all of this. So all of these things are abiding in my awareness, right? Everything that I'm seeing is in my awareness, but they're outside my body. You see that? All of this are in my awareness, but they're outside my body. But then if we say, well, yeah, but your body is also in your awareness. So then all of these things, including my body, are in my awareness, not outside my awareness. But you can say then, well, my sense organs are aware of these things, but I'm also aware of my sense organs, so they become inside my awareness. My mind becomes inside my awareness because it's also known. And so actually this idea of inside and outside goes away. Because inside, if you say that the purusha is inside the body and outside the body, right? That's from the standpoint of the body. But if you say it's both inside and outside the body, what does that mean? You know, the self, your being, is inside and outside the body. Well, look at this perception. Is the whole thing an awareness or not? It is. Well, that's outside the body. So awareness is outside the body. Yeah, but it's also inside the body. Yeah, but I'm aware of this awareness also. Right, I'm aware of the body also. So that becomes part of the room. Sense organs become part of the room. Mind becomes part of the room. So inside and outside completely goes away. I recognize, in fact, that my being, this conscious being that I am, there is no experience that's away from me. You tell me one experience at any time that's away from consciousness. There isn't one. Why you think there's an inside and outside is because you think that the consciousness belongs to the body. That's where inside and outside comes. But when you recognize that this body is an object of consciousness, that the sense organs are an object of consciousness, the mind is an object of consciousness, inside and outside goes away. And then you have to say, yeah, everything. Everything I experience is in my awareness. There's nothing away from my awareness. Once you break that dehatma buddhi, that identification with the body, everything's in my awareness. There's nothing that's away from me. Nothing. And so you recognize that you are the stable, conscious being that's present to every experience and not away from anything. You're not changed by anything and you're not away from anything. That's sabahya abhyantaraha. And yourself is ajaha. Consciousness, the being that you are, is ajaha, unborn. Okay? You are unborn. How could you be unborn? Well, it's more like saying, how could I be born? Because unless you can objectify consciousness and exist within time and space and have a form, then you can be born. Something can affect you. Something can bring you into being. But if consciousness, if the conscious being that you are, is formless, since it's got no parts, and it can't be objectifiable, what's going to act on it to change it? How can it come into being? From what? From what will it come into being? Because something that's not an object doesn't exist within time and space. It doesn't have a prior condition. Right? It can't be objectified. So ajaha. Being ajaha, I'm going to do this quickly because we have to spend next week on this second half of it. It's apranaha, amanaha. If it's just pure consciousness that can't be objectified, is changeless, has no form, it can't have prana. It can't be active. It can't be like energy that comes and goes. It can't be like the breath, right? Because the breath is something that's objectifiable, right? It's something that changes. Consciousness doesn't change. It's a manaha. It has no mind. It's not thinking. It's not feeling. It's the being, it's the presence, the me, that is present to all those feelings, present to all those thoughts. But itself is not thinking. Right? Itself is not thinking. Right? Consciousness is stable. And so whatever the thoughts are, I am there, stable, present to those thoughts. But I'm not participating in them. That's why I don't become happy or sad or smart or stupid. Right? That's another big relief. If you had a complex that you were stupid, you could... or if you had a worse complex that you're really smart, that's just as irritating. It's nicer if you have your mind and it's a good mind. That's nice, okay? So... That mind also is something which is continually changing, right? Myself is not thinking. I am the one who is present to all of that. So amanaha, that unnegates, right? The unnegates, apranaha, amanaha. Then shubraha. Shubraha means that which is pure. Means for me, there's no raga dvesha. There's no likes or dislikes. There's no agitation in that way. There's no agitation. I am simple. Yourself is profoundly simple. It's accommodative. Whatever is going on, it is present. Just as accommodative as the sun. You know, the sun lights up everything and blesses everything with its light. Right? It warms everything. It doesn't say, oh, I don't like you, I only like you. You know. Or I like this country and not that country. Right? It is present to everything. So like that, my being is not selective. It's not, it doesn't have favorites at all. It blesses everything. And it's never stained by what it blesses. Okay? And so whatever is going on in the mind, if a bunch of adharma and ugliness and nastiness is going on in the mind, I am present to that as much as I am present to whatever beautiful things are going on in the mind. And as soon as the ugly, agitated, unhappy mind changes its thinking patterns, then it reflects me, and the joy it enjoys that. Whenever it relaxes, it enjoys the joy of the reflection of myself. Right, but my presence doesn't change one way or the other. This, whether my mind is reflecting me and feeling a certain sense of peace from its own standpoint, or whether it's agitated and feeling unhappy from its own standpoint. Because it's so pleasure and pain are there in the mind. My ananda is not changed. My self-experience, which is full, is not changed. That's moksha. The moksha, it's a secondary gain. And it is a secondary gain, and it does take place. That when I recognize that the source of the ananda, the fullness that my mind gets to enjoy, is my own self, right? That when my mind relaxes, it reflects the self in a certain way. Like for instance, if I use the water bucket analogy with the sun, if the sun is shining on a clear water bucket, very clear water, there's like a clear reflection in that mind. The mind finds that pleasing. Mind that's pleasing for the mind. Say the water bucket is all dirty, you know, muddy, and the sun isn't reflected in it well. That's a painful experience for the mind. But the sun's experience is different than the mind's, than the clear water or the muddy water. The sun's its own changeless ananda. And the mind, when the mind is relaxed, it reflects the self in a way that it feels comfortable. When the mind is agitated, it doesn't reflect the self in a way that it feels comfortable. But yourself remains as the same ananda, illumining the comfortable and the uncomfortable mind. So both are present. When your mind is happy, my being, as I am, is that ananda that I am, illumines this happy mind. This ananda that I am now illumines the unhappy mind. The freedom is in the differentiation of the ananda that I am always, whether the mind is happy or not. So then my mind enjoys and rests and trusts in that ananda. The unhappy mind bathes itself in that ananda, changeless ananda of myself, and the happy mind just revels in it. Right? The unhappy mind goes to it for love and support, and the changelessness of that wholeness, and the happy mind revels in it. But that wholeness never changes at all. And that's the stable experience, the self-recognition that is the moksha. The mind recognizing that the experience of happiness is only caused by the relaxation of the mind that makes like a clear water bucket, means that the mind becomes independent of the world having to behave in a particular way so that I can be happy. The ignorant mind feels this way. I need you to be like this so I can be happy. I need to get this new job so I can be happy. I need the world to be like this so I can be happy. We're always manipulating because whenever I fulfill a desire, if I get what I want, I fulfill the desire, my mind relaxes and experiences some happiness. And so I think that those objects have given me that. Right? But they haven't. Otherwise, those objects would make me happy all the time. Oh my God. They don't. You know? So what the person has knowledge realizes that it has nothing to do with the object. It has to do with that mind is being relaxed, so the source, the self, it's like the sun shining in that mind, reflects in a way that's very pleasing to the mind. That's a secondary gain. So the mind is free now. It knows where the what the source, what the psychodynamics are of happiness. But the moksha is recognizing, I am Ananda. I am Brahman. I am the Purusha. I am the Divya. I am the one who is changeless. I am the changeless being, and nobody can do anything about it. And this being that I am is Ananda. Right? It's absolutely full and complete. So having differentiated that self out from all the experience, that is the moksha. And then recognizing now what this Upanishad is going to start doing, this chapter is amazing. It's all Ishwara. This whole chapter is really the whole vision of Ishwara, because we got to Shubraha. Now starting this, what we'll start next week, Akshadat Parataha Paraha. It's saying this Divya Purusha, which is yourself, your being, it is this self which is the one which is the very truth of Maya, which itself is Akshara. Akshara being that capacity which is, from which the whole universe comes. So there's going to be kind of a whole unfoldment now around Maya. And then he's going to go into Upasana on understanding Ishwara, understanding this whole creation as a conscious being. That is really just a manifestation. It's a manifestation of this Divya Purusha. So we'll do that next time. Let's take a moment. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.